Hi, Dan.
Hi, Jason.
Happy birthday.
It's not even the right month anymore.
Well, it's close. It's for the next... I just want to point out that for the next 5 months, you and I are both in our 40s.
Oh, well, yeah. We should enjoy this while we can.
Mm-hmm.
When will that come around again?
10 years.
I mean,
or never.
Not our 40s, but yeah. But
yeah, yeah, exactly.
It's nice to be in the same decade again.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's a brief respite. So there's nothing much going on, except there's things going on. It's
stuff.
Funny.
Happening.
I was talking to my neighbor from 10 feet away yesterday, and he was saying how his job is like, he used to be working home 2 days a week, and now it's working home all the time, but that he's keeping busy, and that there is definitely this feeling, I think, among those of us who continue to work and do our things like we did before. It's just, it's weird because the whole world has changed around us, and we're like, yeah, but Apple did a thing, and I wrote an article, and there was a chart, and we just keep on doing stuff.
The more things change, the more they stay the same.
For some. Your book is coming out in a couple weeks, and you wrote a piece on Six Colors about the exciting world of making ebooks.
Yes.
Yay.
That was... Yeah, it was an adventure. It did involve learning some new skills. It did involve finding some new tools. And I learned a lot of things about it, mostly about how I really don't like dealing with publishing platforms. I wish was that there was a better, or publishers were better about finding ways to delegate certain parts of that to the author, in the sense that, so Apple does this pretty well on the bookstore, which is, you can create other users and have people get access to like certain parts of the information, right? Like maybe I can't change stuff in the manuscript, but I could get access to like stats. And so, because right now, you know, I have like my author page on Amazon, and it lets me change some things like my bio and that kind of thing. But right. I can't see, the only stats I can see are the book scan numbers, which are like kind of like the equivalent of Nielsen, but for books. But are notoriously unreliable. And it's like, well, Amazon, you know, when I go on Amazon, Amazon knows exactly how many books they've sold, right? Like, they have that information. I just don't have that information.
Right.
So, yeah, now I do in the ebook world. Like, now when I've distributed all my short stories, I have a full picture of how many times they've been downloaded from all those various stores. But it's annoying because there's 5 different stores plus my own site. And so I have to, you know, essentially make a spreadsheet and go and check every once in a while when I want to see how the numbers are and like update my spreadsheet.
Blurg.
Yeah, it's just a lot of work, right? Yeah. And I mean, there are some services that simplify that kind of thing, but they don't.
Well, can't you just
work
like lean
situation.
Back and wait for the checks to roll in?
Yeah, the free checks. yeah, it's funny. I'm actually stand to earn some royalties on this because of Amazon's stupid. And we talked about this. We didn't talk about this on this podcast. We talked about this like adjacent to some other
podcast. Don't even remember, but you had to charge $1 in some places.
Yeah, right. And well, in theory, Amazon does not let you sell books for free, period, as
I think,
pointed out.
Well, wasn't that last week? Because I was talking about how I told the story about how it used to be because of... Or was that on
yes.
a different...
I think that was on a different podcast, actually.
Wow.
Yeah, I think we might have been talking about that on like a TPK podcast we were
oh,
recording.
Oh, yeah, you're right. You're right, because we were just shooting the breeze
in between
waiting for somebody to come or something like that. Yeah, so that Amazon has this weird structure where in some places you can't charge, and it used to be that they... It may still be that authors get charged for file size, like data transfers above a certain thing, because we had like a limitation, and Take Control has had a limitation with like the size of the books you put in the Kindle store, because they have a bunch of Kindles that are free cellular for life, cellular data,
right.
And on like the previous generation network, and it's slow, but it doesn't matter because it's just ebooks.
Yeah.
But they had Amazon had this weird like, I got an idea, we'll give everybody free cellular, and then at some point somebody was like, oh, but we don't really want to be generous, so we'll just charge the authors for the
right. Thanks.
What?
Yeah, so as a result, you can't make a book free. You have to charge at least, and it varies in every region, but you know, the equivalent of roughly 99 cents.
Yeah.
However, if you put in price matches, like, hey, I saw this over on the Apple bookstore and it was free there, they will lower the prices. But the problem is you have to do it for each individual region. So I did it like as people were like, oh, by the way, it's a dollar in the Australian bookstore. I was like, all right, I'll try to put in a price match. And some were more, you know, quickly responded than others. Mm. But as a result, some people were just like, I'll just buy it. It's fine. It's a dollar or whatever.
Yeah.
And so it's like, well, good. Now I have this random assortment of royalty cards that will be, you know, a few bucks here and there because I'm only getting a percentage of that dollar.
Sure.
You know, I'm getting like 35 cents on the dollar or something yeah. like that. And it's only in certain regions. And then there's probably foreign transaction like problems and all that. So yeah, I hopefully won't lose money. That's my feeling.
That's the goal.
Yeah. But it was a fun project to do. And as I said at the end, I think what the most sort of heartening thing about it was I understand how the process works now. And if I needed or wanted to self-publish something in the future, I feel more prepared
for
that.
That's good.
So that was it was good to sort of build that skill set out and just be like, I wonder how this works. It's cool. Yeah.
I like how anybody who's been through this popped up when you wrote this because, you know, it really is kind of a scarring thing to go through an ebook production. So like John Siracusa popped up and he's like, oh, there's wow, that Kindle preview tool is so much better because, you know, he was doing all of his Ars Technica reviews and doing that. I had forgotten that he had to build his
Kindle
own ebooks. And there's a litany of people at Macworld over the years who had to deal with it. Kelly and Serenity and Heather all had to do that over the course of time. And I'm sure they're all like, ooh, ebooks.
Yeah.
Right? Like,
I got an email. I got an email from our friend John Birmingham, the writer, who was I've been playing around with that too.
Right.
Let me know when your piece goes up because I want to read that.
Yeah. Well, he's interesting because he's got traditional publisher deals, and then he does some stuff self-published. He's a fascinating guy. If people don't know who John Birmingham is, I only know him because this Australian guy won an incomparable contest and made us read one of John Birmingham's books for a podcast, and it's the only time we've ever done that. And I liked his book, and now we know John Birmingham, which is kind of fun.
He's blurbed several of my books.
Yeah, and his stuff is really fun. He's described his books as being like, it's a book you should be able to read on a long plane flight after a couple of drinks. Like that's he wants, and he sells himself short a little bit. Like The Cruel Stars, which nobody's talking about, is one of my favorite books of last year.
It's good.
It's a really good widescreen space opera. There's space Nazis in it. It is that kind of book. It is super widescreen space opera. It's so good. But he also has this Audible.
Yeah.
Series that he's doing where it's these novellas about an apocalypse that are Audible originals. So those are just he sold those direct to Audible, so they don't even get printed. Eventually they'll be printed as, you know, words on a page or on a Kindle, but right now they are audio only. And then he's got like Cruel Stars is a traditional publishing thing, so
we call him a hybrid.
And his last series, which is the one that we actually read for the podcast, which is The Weapons of Choice. It's the it's a 21st century aircraft battle group, basically. American naval battle group gets popped back in time before Pearl Harbor and causes, you know, the timeline to shatter and go in a different direction. And it's all about exploring what happens if a 21st century battle group got dropped in the middle of the Pacific Ocean right before right before Pearl Harbor. Anyway, he finished that series, but he had a bunch of novellas he wanted to write, or they were really kind of like pieces of a novel that he wanted to write. And he self-published all of those.
He's trying
everything. John is.
I've dabbled with that idea too for some other stories that might be related to like the universe that my books are in. So obviously I did my short stories, but a lot of those were things that I had cut from books. Where it's like, oh, this scene, it just doesn't quite fit, or it's too long, or it's in the wrong place, and I don't really need it. But it's like a nice self-contained little story, and so that's sort of what I spun out as those short stories. But I've also had ideas for things that are like, well, this doesn't really fit in any of the stories I am telling here, but it's an interesting bit of like world exploration, like narrative that, you know, might factor into the universe somewhere. I don't know. Maybe I'll write that as a novella at some point.
You can have my whole thing about how Swatch Time is being
used. That's right. That's a whole little
story
there.
It's canon.
Yeah,
it's in the wiki.
True. It's in the wiki.
the I wanted to mention the tech side of this, which is think of all of the very talented writers who are out there who aren't technically proficient enough to do stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
I think about that sometimes of like, there's huge missed opportunity because you can do this. You can have this idea and use it to promote your book. But a less tech-savvy author might have some great stuff that doesn't fit. Or like John Birmingham, although, you know, he's doing a whole bunch of different stuff too. But the idea that there are people out there who maybe just don't think about it or are kind of overwhelmed by the technology of it. And so that stuff just gets left untapped. But you have enough technical acumen to make it happen, which is good because it benefits you as somebody who's got a book to promote.
Right. I mean, it's a nice meshing of my backgrounds, right, in technology and writing. And, you know, it is kind of a sweet spot for me. So, I mean, it's been really nice and the response has been really great. I mean, it got both those short stories were downloaded about 3,000 times in the first 2 weeks, which feels pretty good. Like, you know, if everybody had paid a few bucks for those and then even only half as many people had downloaded it, like, I feel like I would have done okay off that.
I wonder, I mean, this is a side note. We're going to do an incomparable episode in like a week or so about this stuff. So there's more to come. Maybe we should leave it there.
We'll save
there's
some
a lot,
more.
We'll a see lot of interesting, more. A lot of interesting stuff about that maybe I'll talk to you about on that. So we're forward promoting next week's Incomparable, which we haven't recorded yet. We're going to record next week's Incomparable after we record this podcast next week. So stay tuned, I guess. The Apple financials came out.
Yeah.
A
weird bit of semi-normalcy in unnormalcy, although it contains some weird non-normal stuff in it.
Yeah. I mean, everybody was waiting to see like the big changes in the numbers, and there aren't huge changes in the numbers, and that's mostly because it only affected because the quarter is January, February, March, so it was toward the end of March that things got very weird worldwide, the last half of March, but things were already weird in China earlier, so China took a bigger hit to Apple's. Stats
they did
then.
A smart thing in talking about this, both Tim and Luca, and clearly that was sort of their game plan, was like, let's divide the quarter into three sections.
Uh-huh.
One, the first was like,
we're killing
things
it.
Are kind of normal.
It's going to be a
the
record.
Second is,
it's going to be
exactly.
Great.
It's going to be great. Second is, something's going on in China that's affected our supply lines and the demand in China, but it's just China. And the third is, every place but China now.
Yeah.
China's rebounding. Everything else is not doing so great.
Right. Right. And that was the kind of two-sided approach that they took in talking about the future is sort of like, well, China's doing better now,
right?
But everywhere else is not. But, you know, we could maybe look at China and say that that'll happen elsewhere, but we don't really know if that's the case or not. I also thought that it was interesting where they kind of like put things in different buckets about like the Mac and the iPad are doing great because people are realizing that they need equipment to work out of their houses and stuff like that. And they're buying iPads and they're buying Macs and stuff. And I think they're right about that. And they talked about a deployment, I guess Peloton overnight told all of their employees in New York to stay home. And they all got laptops deployed to them via Apple like the next day. That was one of their examples of like they got a, you know, deployed 1,000 Macs to everybody who works at that company. And I'm sure that there's a lot of that going on too, right? Where they're deploying and schools are deploying iPads and there's a lot of that going on. But on the other side, you know, other stuff, wearables and iPhone are less necessary in this kind of scenario. So I think they did a pretty good job of kind of showing what's going on now because the financial community really wants to know that, and also doing this another split message. There's a lot of that, which is we're optimistic in the long run. I'll point out, I did in my article on Macworld this week, that they've got like $90 billion in cash.
Bank.
They actually have $190 million in cash, but they have like $190 billion in cash. But they also have debt of about $100 billion, and that's just kind of a you know, sometimes the cash or cash equivalents isn't as easy, or there's repatriation or do that. So they have a mix. But the net cash on hand is like $90 billion. And that means that in the long run, Apple's going to be fine. Apple can weather the storm. It's not going to be a problem for them. And in fact, the truth is, and they alluded to this slightly, somebody asked them directly about it, and they're like, yeah, they didn't go into it too deeply. But it's the idea that the last time this happened in 2007, Apple also had money, not the kind of money they've got now, but they also had money, and they stuck to their guns, but they also like invested through the downturn. And the whole idea there about investing through a downturn is when everything is less valuable because it's a downturn and you've got a big pile of $90 billion in cash, you know, you can like buy stuff. You can make favorable contracts for purchasing. You can buy companies that are down on their luck. It's one of those moments that like if Elon Musk, as we're recording this, is just a crazy person on Twitter.
Yep.
But and I was talking to Stephen Hackett about this, and I theorized some things about why he's doing this. But one theory is like Tesla, with their factory shut down in California, it's really, really like that is a company that has always been managed on the razor's edge. And I wonder if Elon Musk freaking out about California still being shut down is in part because he's really in fear of Tesla falling apart as a company. And I'm just using this as an example. Like, say Tesla were to fall apart as a company because of this shutdown and because of the economics currently, that's a case where if Apple still fancied the idea of building a car, that, you know, Apple could just come in and buy it for like you know, half price or whatever. And if not something so high profile, like if there's a company with a good technology that Apple fancies, but they're having cash flow problems, they're not going to be able to make it, and Apple has been watching them during this downturn, they can pounce. Now, is that a happy story that the economy is so bad that companies are getting desperate and giant companies are buying them out? I think for the diversity of the ecosystem, probably not. Like, but it does, if you're looking just at Apple, it is a period of opportunity for them because they've got $90 billion in a mattress somewhere that they can use.
Yeah, no, I think it's a good point that Apple, they focus on how they've managed this for the long term, right? And like, that's what they're in this for.
And that's because they gave no guidance for the short term, which is literally we don't know what's going. Wall Street looks at the guidance, they're like, how does Apple think they're going to do next quarter? And they price the stock based on the guidance and all that. And this time Apple was like, we got no guidance. We have no idea what's going to happen.
Right, exactly. Wow. And so they can afford to say we're looking at the long term, because when you're sitting on $90 billion, like, you're not going to go out of business.
Right.
You can afford to pay your
employees.
Somebody
did that analysis that you could literally shut down Apple completely and continue to pay the employees from their cash hoard, and you could go for like 30 years.
Yeah, it'd be ridiculous. I mean, like, this morning there was a link going around about how much money Jeff Bezos has. And like, you can kind of, you know, throw Apple into a similar bucket in terms of like, people just think of, you know, it's hard to conceptualize that billion thing, right? Like, 90 billion is so much money that you could easily afford to pay everybody, even if you were not making a single product. But they are making products, right? Like,
they are still, and
there will be disruptions. I think everybody acknowledges that like some stuff is going to slow down. But, you know, Tim pointed out that they shipped several products in this past quarter and to, you know, good responses. Yeah. And it's not as though, I haven't heard anything about there being shortages of any of those products either.
No.
Their supply chain, you know, which is interesting because a couple months ago when we talked about this, they're one of the points of concern, which somebody asked about yesterday, was like, do you worry about essentially your supply chain is not diverse enough? And Tim made the point about that. He's like, well, I think people get confused about the final assembly because really our supply chain is all over. We source stuff from a lot of different places.
Very diverse.
It's just that it's mainly assembled in China, and some assembly is done in other places, but mainly in China. But because their supply chain bounced back so much more quickly, I think, than everybody expected.
Yeah.
Like, they did not really end up with much of a disruption, or at least the disruption was not transparent.
Right.
Maybe that SE was supposed to ship a couple weeks earlier, but nobody knew. So there's no way to know, to say like, oh, it was delayed. We don't know when it was intended to ship. The iPhone in the fall will be a bigger question,
right?
I think mainly because that does have an established pattern of when it tends to ship.
Yeah, and the rumors are that they may spread that out and ship multiple models, you know, in waves and stuff like that, because we'll see. The other part of what they said that I thought was interesting was, of course, we'll look at this all in our processes about the supply chain afterward and see if there's anything we can learn to be better there, which first off, Tim Cook answered a lot of the supply chain questions in detail, and I thought it was funny because that is not something the CEO would do normally in a situation like that, but it's Tim Cook. Tim Cook knows all the he was talking about like NAND pricing, and right. And I'm like, wow. But then I thought, oh, but it's Tim Cook. Of course he knows the details.
This is stuff. He knows all this.
Of supply. This is his thing. But embedded in that to me was, we are very confident in our global supply chain, and you mischaracterize it when you say it's all happening in China because it comes from all over the world. But of course, we'll learn lessons from this. And I read that as probably suggesting, maybe they're not intending this, but I look at that and think, maybe what you learned is you got to always have a backup. Maybe that's it. Maybe you learned that two is one and one is none, and that you should have two assembly locations, because what if one of the assembly locations goes down?
Right. I mean, and that's true for things beyond just this kind of illness too, right? Like what if there were a big earthquake in that area in China, right? Like
or a war or a natural disaster of some kind.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Sure.
So I do think about that. The other thing that they said that I thought was funny was they characterized everybody working from home. And mm-hmm. what
some people are more productive, some people are less productive.
Some people are less productive. And so my question was, what happens now? Like,
Spill the tea, Tim.
First off, yeah, I want to know. It's like, well, obviously our detailed hardware design group can't really function remotely. And because there are, I'm sure, functions that are really good for work from home and ones that are really bad. But my question...
Oh, Eddie Q is just bouncing around. He's not. He's bored.
My question is, will they change their operations based on what they've learned? Because I would say, and again, I don't think this is going to happen, but I hope it does, which is, if you learned during this process that some parts of Apple are better,
mm-hmm.
that's what he said, better remotely, and some are worse, will you change your corporate culture to take some of your groups that are better remotely and either make them virtual, make them remote, or change your hiring processes so that you hire people who are not local? Because I've railed about this before, but like Apple's insistence on everybody coming to Cupertino means that they lose a lot of really talented people who don't want to live in the Bay Area, in the South Bay. And also, they're probably paying people more than they actually would need to.
Cost of living.
If they lived in a cheaper location. So I gotta wonder... If you've got groups where the function works fine remotely or maybe better, maybe take that as a lesson and not have them all live in Cupertino. Because I know for a fact, you know, some groups, like there's the App Store editorial group, right? Which is
they're writing
articles and commissioning articles and commissioning art and stuff. It is a pure editorial operation. And like, if you want to work in the US version of that, you gotta go to Cupertino every day. And it doesn't make any sense that you have to do that, but corporate culture decided that they had to do that. So if they find that group is not necessary in that way, would they change it so that people could work from home from Montana or wherever?
Yeah, I think the change will be forced upon them, honestly, right? Because not only because of what's happening right now, but because as things do maybe shift back towards the more normal way of doing things, it's not like, again, it's not like anyone's flipping a light switch and everybody's like, all right, we all go back to Apple Park today, right? Like, they're going to have to phase people in.
Right.
And if you're smart, you're going to say, well, the last people that we need to bring back into the office immediately are the people who seem to be doing fine.
Doing great,
working from home.
Especially if you need to spread people out, right?
Right, exactly. If you're only going to say we can only accommodate a quarter of the staff on like a daily basis, why not? Just keep the people who are productive.
Get
at
the
home.
ones who are a disaster need to come into the
bring
office.
Them in.
Now.
Bring them in. They got to get back to work.
So we'll see. I mean, this is and it stems from Steve Jobs, and Steve Jobs is responsible for Apple's corporate culture, and so much of it is good, and there are things about it that I don't like and I think are detrimental, and the insistence that everybody be physically present is one of them. I also wonder about their open office environment and if mm-hmm. if this will make them rethink that, but I doubt it will, because unless this kind of distancing has to go on for like forever. But assuming that it's only a year, you know, or two, and then it sort of passes, I do have those moments where I'm like, maybe convert those to offices. Like, maybe you want to do that.
Even in the,
even in the short
Johnny
term.
Johnny Ive back, and yeah. he'll have to design some very nice offices, some cutting edge.
Well, I even wonder, even in the short term, if you're Apple and you've got $90 billion in the bank, if you start, and construction is now allowed in California again, you say, we're gonna convert part of Apple Park so that it's usable for the next year. And then
I think they have to.
I don't know. So that's all, you know, interesting stuff that we gleaned from that phone call with analysts.
Yeah, no, I agree.
You and I both tossed out some wish list items.
You wrote about translation in messages, which I think is a great point, especially because, as I pointed out to you elsewhere, like, Siri does translations. You can ask Siri like how to say something in a different language. It's not like they don't have access to that on the back end.
And you can see it in Facebook and you know, Twitterific does it for me. The idea that you can on device detect that this is not in a language that's one of your primary languages and offer a translation. And yes, you probably have to go out to a cloud-based translation service, but, you know, I feel like it is baffling to me how, if you're trying to have a conversation with somebody who speaks a language you don't, that you have to copy the text, go to Google Translate, paste it in, get the result, read it, write a response, copy that, go back to messages, paste it back in. It's like, this is a super smart device that can translate things on the fly using existing web services. Why has Apple never done, and plus, and I realize they probably just didn't build the API right for this, but, like, there's literally a messages app store, and yet there's still no translation apps in there either. There's a translation keyboard that iTranslate has, but of course that's only one way. It doesn't translate what they're saying. It only will translate what you say when you send it back.
And it's funny too, because when I do my, like, roundup every once in a while, where I compare the voice assistant, Siri, I think, has the broadest availability language wise. Mm. Like, they spend a lot of time localizing it for lots of different places, which Amazon and Google have not done as much.
Yeah.
And Google really has some amazing technology when it does come to the real-time translation stuff. And if I were Apple, I would be investing heavily in something to compete with that and integrating it into things like FaceTime and messages and all that stuff, because I feel like the possibilities there are huge and they have the resources to do it. And it's just a thing where, you know, they talked yesterday about in the financial call about how much FaceTime and message traffic has increased and how it's hit, you know, basically new daily highs all the time because everybody's being forced to communicate remotely. And so adjusting to that and realizing, oh no, these technologies, which maybe were sort of ancillary technologies, but are now becoming things people really depend on, we have to actually change our viewpoint because people are using them so much they're exposing problems with them, such as as in the 13.5 beta, where they found a way to finally turn off that, like, make whoever is talking in group FaceTime calls, like, enlarge their portrait slowly because it was unusable.
Yeah.
And so they had there, but they're real. Nobody thought that they're like, oh, this is really clever, let's just do it. And the answer was very few people used that service, I think, before. And so people might have complained about it, but it's not like now where it's all of a sudden everybody is using it and everybody is realizing this is a bad experience. So there's an opportunity here for them.
Yeah. And then you mentioned autocorrect, which has been killing you. And it's been killing me too. They're the things. It feels to me like autocorrect, it's a black box, so it's very hard to tell, but it feels to me like it needs a rethink.
Yes.
Right? Like, it needs to work
ground up
differently and provide different options and everybody has these stories. I have these instances where I'm typing something that very obviously is a specific word and it does nothing, or it corrects it to something that is not remotely in any context or any spelling related to the word that it is one letter away from, and I think, what are you doing, and for that to be the case, something has really gone wrong, and it makes me feel like this is technology that they've been patching for 10 years and they need to throw away.
This is exactly what it feels like to me. It feels like it's six different systems that were each kind of half built on top of each other.
Yeah.
Like you said, patched slowly, like, oh, okay, maybe it'd be good if we handle this, but we're not going to, like, rework the original system. We're just going to layer something else on top of it, like the predictive text bar, right? Which is like, why is there a predictive text bar and also a method for correcting things, like, that looks totally different, right?
That one blows me away that it will suggest something. But then, and sometimes it won't suggest anything, but then it'll run a line under it, and if you tap it, it'll suggest different things. Like, what is happening?
It's two different things that aren't talking to the right hand, left hand, not talking to each other. And it's really weird. And so I think it does feel like 13 years in, it's time to sort of tear that all down and start from scratch with all the things that you've learned over the last 13 years, because we have all gotten very used to it, right? Like autocorrect in the earliest days, everyone was trying to kind of figure out, oh, I've got like this software keyboard on screen. It's a little weird. I don't know where to put my thumbs. And Apple's like, look, we'll just make it a lot easier for people. Correct your typing. You'll be smarter about which keys you're hitting.
The whole idea was type with confidence, even if you aren't quite hitting the letters right.
Right.
Because we know what you were trying to do and we can figure it out. That was the premise.
But people have adapted. Yeah. And now people are like, I mean, I don't, you know, I'm sure your kids are much better at this even than
I'll
we
tell you,
are.
I have those moments. My most frustrating autocorrect moments are that I'm a pretty good typist, thumb typist.
Same. Yeah.
And I type all the letters exactly the way I want and I press space and it changes to something else. And I think, no, but I can't turn off autocorrect, because when I do that, I realize that there are all sorts of other cases where I do things like I don't put the apostrophes in because I know it's going to autocorrect
exactly.
it properly, and I can't. So I know it's a hard problem, but it feels like they've built this, you know, beaver dam of tech, and they need to, you know, blow it open and build a new dam.
The one in that piece I linked to where it was talking about the, like, I go to hit space and I hit like C or something, and I end up with this really long, like, three words glued into one with C's in between them instead of spaces. That happens to me all the time. It's maddening. Or like I go to hit something in the bottom right corner and I hit delete or return instead, and it's just like, maybe my thumbs are too big, or maybe I'm aiming wrong, but it's maddening.
You know, it still does the thing that also killed me, which is it autocorrects to a proper name with a capital letter, and you back all the way back to the beginning of the word and start to type and realize that it's going to force that first letter to be capitalized because it was capitalized in the autocorrect, even though I never capitalized it. I get that it's hard. This is very hard stuff. It just feels, from the outside looking in, that it's messed up in so many different ways that intuitively I say, it seems to me like you've lost control of your whole system and you need to, pull it back. You need to start from scratch.
Cross purposes with itself.
Or go up a few levels and give it a rethink. And I think give it an interface rethink too, right? Like that's part of it too, is somebody was pointing out to you, maybe in the member Slack, about the idea of being able to pick the word and choose like what ending, what form of the word it could take. And I thought, that's actually pretty smart, right? Like you're autocorrecting, and I've had that where you're autocorrecting it to a word that's close to the word that I want, but not quite right. And sometimes I'll actually tap it and then back up and change the ending to an ing or an ed or whatever, because it was offering me a version of the word, but the wrong version. And I don't know. Until they can just send our messages for us using brain power, then this is what they need to do.
It's coming. It's coming eventually.
No, but I'm glad you wrote that piece because, you know. Ugh. What else? Anything else? I don't know.
I don't know. I think the big question now that everybody is looking forward to try and figure out is what's going to happen with WWDC.
Right.
Which is now about a month away-ish.
We entered the window.
When we expected it.
We entered the window in a month.
And Tim mentioned on the call that it was, you know, they talked about sort of prepping for it and the fact that it's coming and like the teams were working on it. But they didn't give any more details about when it starts or what kind of stuff we're going to expect. It's interesting to look at what some of the other companies have done. I think just yesterday as well, Microsoft announced that it was making Build, which is its big developer conference. I think they said they're making it free. Because it used to be like WWDC, like, you know, you could get some content probably, but like attending was a couple thousand dollars or something like that. And so I think that's an interesting question for Apple too, right? Like, you could get most of the content if you were a developer, or even just, I think you only needed like a free account, or did you need a developer account to get like the videos and stuff after the fact? I'm not even sure.
Used to be you needed a developer account, not the case anymore.
Right. So the question is, well, obviously if you're Apple, you can't be like, we're charging our $1,700.
No.
Right? Like you can't do that.
I don't think they are. I think if they charge for anything at all, it will be for like personal you know, personal help, like, support
lab
kind of stuff.
Time or something. Or?
But I bet they, yeah, I bet they don't even go down that path. And it's like, if you're a paid developer, you've got access to the developer forums, but we're just going to post stuff on the internet.
Right. Yeah. And everything else can be free. Well, which is interesting. There's a lot of big questions about that. And then there's questions of how they're producing all this content with people at home. Like, sure, it's doable. But like Apple, the thing is that Apple has such high standards, right? Like they everything is kind of, you know, the formats of slides and the way people, like, they take a lot of time training people to do their talks. And like, so it's not like you can just have someone in their, you know, living room and someone else in their basement and all this stuff recording stuff. They're going to want to exert some control over it. And it's going to be interesting to see how they deal with that, whether it's like people are coming into some, you know, studio with a limited, you know, maybe there's just a control room with a person in it, and then there's like a studio that gets wiped down and everything, or whether they're deploying equipment to people's houses to let them do that in place. I'm just fascinated. I think it's a really big, it's not out of their power or ability to make this happen. I'm just curious what choices they're going to make in producing it.
Yeah. And my theory has been, why is it even a week? Why would it not just be a kickoff week followed by additional material? I mean, the reason you do it in a short period of time, other than that people are present in a physical location, is you're releasing the beta and you really want to give people the documentation, basically, for this new version of the operating systems so that you can they can use it. But I could totally see continuing education thing where, like, we can't produce every session week one, but we can do top level and we can do some documentation. And then we're going to roll out new videos every week or every day for all summer, maybe, or, you know, at the very least, maybe for all of June. But who knows? Who knows? They may. The beauty of it is they could choose a different path. They don't need to emulate WWDC proper. They can do it in a different way. And honestly, they were a lot of those sessions. I mean, having gone to WWDC the last few years, and I mean, I've gone to WWDC since the 90s. Okay. I've a very long time doing WWDC, but the modern WWDC, since they don't do Q&As, unless you go to the labs and all that, like a lot of those sessions, like literally you might as well watch it on video.
Yeah. There's no point. You'll get a better seat. You'll be able to see things more clearly. It's all going to be much better.
Yeah.
It's really the labs. And, you know, there's some fun to it being, you know, being in the keynote room, obviously.
Sure.
Because of the reaction. And that's going to be interesting, too, because it's going to be, you know, like all the late night hosts working without audiences. It's going to be interesting to see how the presenters rethink stuff because they're playing off an audience, or they're expecting audience, some better than others. Like, well, I think Craig Federighi plays really well off an audience.
That magic, but the magic keyboard video was pretty good. Thing. And Craig Federighi did that, right? And that was
I think that was proof of concept. I argued at the time for what they're looking at for WWDC, and I think what I expect to see, at least from the high level stuff, is going to look a lot like that. Is my guess.
Yeah, yeah. I think
you don't need somebody to get up on a stage giving a PowerPoint presentation. Like, there's literally no point to that for a keynote because there's no one in the audience.
Honestly, the Apple Park stuff that they shot for that Magic Keyboard presentation, that's like Apple Park is a great set.
Yeah, sure.
Right? Absolutely. It's gorgeous. They can shoot with, they got the trees behind them out the glass window, and they got those interesting interior spaces. Like,
it's way better than putting them up on the stage in the Steve Jobs Theater and making them talk to an empty room, which is going to feel super weird.
I don't know if it got released publicly or not, but like I saw a video that they shot which was basically the PR briefing for the new MacBook Air and iPad Pro, and that was in the lobby of the Steve Jobs Theater.
Okay.
So they're basically standing there with
like
the
Apple Store-y kind of place.
Yeah, it was completely empty circle with glass, and then the Apple Park off in the background with trees. And so it's just a very nice controlled environment that is very Apple-y for people to talk about things. It's like that's probably the way to do this. And in fact, I can even see them, because of like social distancing and all that, I can see them setting up like a little set of mini presentation studios somewhere where, you know, it's your day next Thursday to come in and record your thing, and you actually come in to the office and there's a setup, right. And they, you know, and there's somebody maybe in the in another room who will start the recording, and then you'll give your presentation, and then you move them out and bring in another person, but you just kind of keep it going in a way that is safe, but is still a little bit more of a controlled environment. I wouldn't surprise me if they do something like that, rather than just have everybody do it from their house. Although they could, because a lot of those presentations didn't ever show the person, right? A lot of
just like a voiceover.
Yeah, the high level ones did, but a lot of them it was literally just a voice and slides. And at that point,
and you might still do that. Yeah,
you could totally do that for the stuff that's not the high level, the highest level stuff.
Right. It's a lot easier to do that, too, because it's a lot easier to cut your audio in on like a slideshow presentation than cut video. It's just it's easier. You can do more takes, and like it's not as cumbersome. And if you're at home and have a good mic and a reasonably quiet room, you're set, right? Like you don't need a video set and lighting and a good camera and someone to work a camera and all of that. You can just record a voiceover as you look at like a screen. So, yeah, it may be that there's a sliding scale of things that they're doing for that, and they're doing a mix of people at home and people coming into a set. So, but again, it's interesting. They've never had to deal with this before, as none of these companies have. So seeing what they decide to do, and especially because, you know, it may have an impact longer term. I mean, you know, despite all the stuff that's being talked about with opening up parts of the country, you know, I look forward to August, when I still have a conference that has not been canceled yet, and I think to myself, 70,000 people in one place? You think we're going to be there by August? I do not.
No, it's not going to happen.
Yeah, but the Gen Con has not been willing to call it yet, but I think they will.
It's Indiana.
Yep.
It's Indiana. That's your problem.
But I mean, you know, even if the argument is, well, it's a huge economic income for all the people who come here, the answer is no one is going to.
No one's going to go.
I can't even imagine half of those people showing up.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the untold thing. Not to get to the pandemic policy part of the program, congratulations. We opened the movie theaters. I am not going to a movie theater, folks.
I don't even want to get on. Like John August, a friend of ours and a noted screenwriter, was tweeting the other day about like, I think he did a Twitter poll about like, when do you think the next time you'll fly is? And I was like, yeah, I don't want to. Somebody posted a tweet about like with an animation of how a sneeze spreads on a plane.
Oh, yeah.
They're going, I'm not getting on a plane.
Well,
I'm pulling my best Mr. T right now. I ain't getting on no plane.
I'll tell you, I've got some plane reservations that were super cheap for Hawaii in October. And if Hawaii is allowing visitors in October, I will do that. But I'll tell you, I'm going to be wearing a mask the whole way, right? Like that for sure. I'm probably going to be like double masking it, mask with a mask underneath. But
you get a snorkel and a scuba gear.
Yeah,
and
but I'll do that if the situation warrants. But I think that says it right. Is like that's a refundable plane ticket. And
yeah, I'm going to keep
my eye on it.
We have tickets. We were supposed to go to South Africa in September. I don't think that's happening.
Yeah.
18 hours in a plane is a bit long for me in September when in that current situation. It was already kind of dicey with it being that on a plane that long, but right now it just does not feel.
Well, our plan was to go for our assorted 50th birthdays sometime next year to Australia. And I still want to do that, but it really is going to be contingent on the current situation. But again, I'm watching the cheap. Here's my tip, people. There are a lot of cheap flights. I do Scott's Cheap Flights, which if people don't know about it, it's a subscription service where it's probably not the best time for it, but they've actually been great. It's flight deals that get sent to you from that are going out of your home airport or airports. And right now, all of their deals they have to be refundable, and they have to be at least like 5 months out.
Yeah,
but one of these days I'm going to see an Australia or New Zealand flight deal for sometime early 2021, and I'm going to buy it. But it's more of speculation. Like I actually found one that was really good, but it was we were going to have to fly from here to Vancouver and then fly to Australia, and I'm like, oh my god, adding more time on a flight to Australia is really bad. But the flight was like $200.
Oh my gosh.
And it was one of those things that's like, well, no, I can't do it. Like, I'd rather find a deal that was more expensive, but actually more direct. But I'm looking at those, and it's going to be the same thing. It's just going to be kind of, I want to make an optimistic bet on the future, and it essentially costs me nothing because it's refundable, or even if it's like refundable for credit that you need to use within a year or something like that. Like,
right.
The airlines are motivated in some cases to like do some of this speculation. So that's where I am, is I'm basically making like wacky speculative flight plans, which is not usually what I do.
Right.
But it may pay off. And if not, I walk away with some, you know, some flight credit and go travel.
I got credit back up for, so we were supposed to be, for my 40th birthday, we were supposed to be in Disney World.
Yeah.
And we got everything refunded except for the tickets to Disney World itself, because Disney basically extended them out more or less through the end of the year. And the answer is the same thing. It's like, well, we'll hold them.
Yeah, either you'll be able to go back, or they're going to extend right. it again, because yeah, people aren't going to be able to go back.
Right. Or worst case scenario, they're like, well, they pretty much always hold their value, so at some point you could just like essentially pay the difference when they reopen up. It's like, what's the... Yeah.
My guess is either they will open up with limited capacity, at which point they're going to have to extend your refund, your usage right. period, because they're not going to be able to get people in the park that much.
Right.
Or they'll just
Disney's not going to walk away with my money on this, because they know how angry that would
shady,
make everybody.
Shady fly-by-night operation. Yeah. I don't know.
I don't trust them.
So, you know, that's the... It is a great question of when do you travel again, when do you fly again? Other than having to drive to Oregon to pick up all of Jamie's things in her dorm room, which we have to do in the next couple of months, or next month, and I think it's like next 6 weeks we have to do that. We're probably going to do that soon, but that's it. That's that, and that's going to be a drive 9 hours, sleep, pack up the room, drive 9 hours, home. Like, that's what that's going to be. It's not going to be a pleasant trip.
I think the next trip that I think is in any way remotely likely for us might be Christmas, but
up in the air. Well, Hawaii in October, I've got down as like a, at this point, I'd say it's 50-50, mm-hmm. but it's like the flights were so cheap that I'm willing to do that, because there's no real risk to me. I'll just take flights in 2021 instead. But I also want to forgive me if I've talked about this on this podcast before, I don't know, but it's like, I want to have something to hang on to as like, maybe I'll do that. Maybe things will work out and we'll get to go to Hawaii in October. And it's like, I get to think about Hawaii. It's nice. Sure. And if it isn't working out, I can say, all right, it's not working out, we're going to move it. And I'm not going to feel too sad about it, because I think the situation will emerge naturally, right? It'll get to September or August and I'll be like, that's not going to happen. You know, or the state of Hawaii says, no, don't come here. But we'll see. I like having it. I like, this is, so what's the line in, there's a Death Cab for Cutie song. It's like, plans are a tiny, what is it? Now I'm going to get it wrong. But the idea is that plans are basically a bet against time. Like,
right.
And I like plans, because a plan in dark times, a plan is optimistic, right? In carefree times, a plan can be making an assumption that maybe you shouldn't make. But in dark times, I feel like a plan is optimism. It's like, you know what? I felt good when I made those plane reservations for October. And will I take them? I don't know. But I felt good. Like, maybe there's a future where I go to Hawaii.
Right.
Let's see what happens. And that's that's where I am right now, is not Hawaii. It's just Hawaii in my mind. Yeah.
Yep. I get you.
That's it. All right. Well, everybody out there, take care. Be safe. And we'll be back next week. And we'll have more book talk, Dan writing talk, too, next week.
Woo!
Until then, bye, Dan.
Bye, Jason.